is the Islamic law about the money which is earned, the income made from selling haram food stuff, you know, in a cooperative, in a big, for example, place, especially when it is destined to be distributed among the shareholders.
The income, okay. Well, it is not permissible to sell or offer, you know, intoxicants to a client.
Yes.
You know, alcohol or wine or things like that. In that, the answer given by the religious authorities is very clear. And I think all the Shia scholars are unanimous when it comes to selling haram things like intoxicants, wine, and alcohol. Is absolutely forbidden, and it's not permissible to do anything concerning intoxicants. And when it comes to pork, of course, the position is also clear. The religious authorities, including His Eminence Ayatollah Khamenei, are of the view that, of course, selling and buying pork are not permissible as a measure of precaution, because he has exercised precaution and when it comes to selling or buying pork, of course. And he says that it's not permissible to distribute the proceeds among shareholders, the proceeds of the pork, you know, that's something, because pork is essentially impure, and something which is essentially impure cannot be sold and cannot be possessed, cannot be distributed among other people. Even the proceeds cannot be distributed as a measure of precaution, and this is what His Eminence says. Of course, this is the position declared by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei when it comes to pork, and also when it comes to meat, which is forbidden and which is haram to consume.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sher Shavit. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chawbid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the religious laws about business. Well, Sheikh Chawbid, you know, we know that a lot of people work in the hotel industry, you know?
Yes, of course.
And just along with the non-Muslims in the non-Muslim countries or non-Islamic dominated countries, you know? So related to the norms of social behavior in those countries, the owner has to serve many other things which are not considered to be halal by the Muslims or the Islamic Sharia law, right? Like alcoholic drinks, for example, or
yes,
other food stuff, as we know. Well, so some of them might be haram, like the pork, as you know, all right? Or as
yes,
you mentioned in the previous question.
Yes.
To the customers. So they have to serve it, in fact, to whoever, you know, comes to the hotel or to the restaurants, for example, of the hotel.
Yes.
So otherwise, they will not go to their hotel. If they don't do it, if they don't give that service, right, to the customers, the
yeah,
customers would not rate it, for example, a high rank hotel, and then they will refuse to go there, and they will go to the other hotel, so they would end up losing their industry at
sure,
the end of the day, right? So it is also to be noted that the businessman, if, well, we propose or we suppose that the business person is Muslim, intends to dispose of all the profit made on the haram food given in the hotel, in the relevant hotel, right? And drink the haram food and drink, but and by giving it to a hakim shar, for example, is it permissible for him to do so, to stay in that business?
Again, I have to further explain the answer I gave in the previous question, as part of the answers to the previous question. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, there is no problem in doing business as a hotelier or as someone who serves or as a server or as a waiter or as the, let's say, the manager of a merchandise or a hotel or restaurant, you know, in non-Muslim countries. It is permissible. But of course, it's not permissible to sell or offer, you know, people intoxicants. That's the main point. You may have you may run a hotel or a coffee shop or something like that in a non-Muslim country. But what is extremely and of course, without any doubt, forbidden is the sale and purchase of intoxicants. And one should not offer such things also, even if he possesses in his stock such things. First of all, he should destroy them. He should not sell them. And if he wishes to offer, he should understand that it's haram, and he cannot possess or take ownership of the proceeds of those intoxicants. And as I said, as in a hotel, you are not going to serve or sell intoxicants only. Intoxicants is a part of one of the many things that may be given or served or offered to the clients. The main thing that people come to the hotel for is food, okay?
Except that it's not the pork or the other stuff.
Yeah, when it comes to pork, of course, the religious authorities have exercised precaution, and they say that it's not permissible as a measure of precaution to sell pork. I think since we have discussed it in the previous episode as well, pork is something which is considered to be impure. An impure thing cannot be sold. Like, for example, you cannot sell something like filthy objects to people and take money for it. Filthy objects cannot be sold, cannot be, distributed, and cannot be given to someone as a gift or something like that. Now, if you want to have, for example, if someone gives you a gift of a bottle of alcohol.
You mean the trade is in and of itself haram and annulled?
Yeah, and of course it is.
Or false.
It is invalid in the first place.
Yes.
Now, because I have come to across people who ask questions, they said, okay, someone has given me a bottle of alcohol as a gift. What should I do? Should I give it to someone, to a non-Muslim or not? Should I just throw it away?
Right.
The answer is clear. He should throw it away. He cannot gift it to a non-Muslim, even if that may come as a very good thing for that non-Muslim, okay? He cannot sell it. He cannot gift it, and he cannot receive money for it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, artistic news, w- with the light.
Iran is the land of saffron, and the red gold has earned the country a fortune throughout the centuries. Now Iran's city of Torbat Haydariya has hosted a saffron photography festival as a means to introduce the lucrative product to the world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Like gold, it is weighed in shekels, not in kilos. And that's why saffron is called the red gold, reflecting how precious it is economically. Torbat Haydariya in northeast Iran is the hub of saffron cultivation in the country, producing an average of 20 million tons of the crop each year. Now the city hosts the Festival of Saffron Photography every year to introduce Iran as the land of saffron and how these hard-working farmers produce the strategic crop.
Photographers present in this festival should use their artistry to shed light on different stages of saffron harvest all the way to the final product. Everyone knows Iranian saffron, but perhaps few know how it's produced. So this festival highlights this issue using photography.
Photography is a universal language that needs no translation, so their photos can better introduce this strategic plant to the world from unique angles.
This year, Iran exported roughly 300 tons of saffron, generating more than $350 million in income, according to the data provided by the Ministry of Agriculture. Experts believe Iran could have a much higher share of the global trade of saffron if it pays better attention to branding and marketing of the product.
Due to favorable weather conditions, Iranian saffron is unique in the world. But unfortunately, in many countries, it's smuggled in bulk and is packaged under foreign brands and then sold at higher prices. If we can brand it inside Iran, then we can export it more efficiently.
The young farm owner says his saffron is exported to Europe and the Middle East, despite the restrictions caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran. But more than the U.S. measures, he's concerned about the impact of climate change on saffron cultivation, warning of what he calls saffron immigration from his city, if authorities remain idle.
Unfortunately, saffron is gradually leaving our region and moving to western parts of Iran. This is due to changes in weather conditions and declining rainfall here. If the government helps farmers with modification of planting patterns, we can stop this disaster.
Over the past 2 years, Iran has expanded its cultivation area for saffron to 115,000 hectares, nearly 20 times more than the entire worldwide land dedicated to the crop. While the Iranian red gold is mainly cultivated in the northeastern Khorasan province, other parts of the country, including Khuzestan and Chaharmahal Bakhtiari, are also fertile for saffron farming.
For centuries, saffron has been a key word in Iran's economy, and still is today. Now, Saffron Photography Festival says many know Iran by its red gold, but through the photos shot here, they will get a glimpse of the mesmerizing saffron farms in Iran and how this amazing crop is produced. Yusuf Jalali from the saffron farms in the suburbs of Torbat Haydariya.
Chinese aerobatic teams have been performing jaw-dropping stunts to mark the 73rd anniversary of the People's Liberation Army Air Force. Pilots wowed the audience with their complicated maneuvers, such as swooping close to the ground, making loops and rolls. Aerobatic teams use red, yellow and blue smoke trails representing the flag of the Chinese Air Force. The Hongying aerobatic team, also known as the Red Eagle, is made up of 10 JL-8 trainer planes and 20 pilots from the Air Force Aviation University. The performance was part of China's International Aviation and Aerospace exhibition held in southern China. The exhibit typically draws thousands of participants in the field of aviation from countries all over the world.
Iran has unveiled the new jersey for its national football team for the upcoming 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar. The newsboy's attire was showcased during a special ceremony in the capital, Tehran. The event was attended by some of the biggest names in Iran's soccer federation and included a series of entertaining performances. One objective of the ceremony was to see off the national soccer team, who will be making the trip to Qatar in less than a week. The jersey has been created by an Iranian sportswear designer who designed official jerseys for several Iranian sports teams taking part in international competitions. The heavily anticipated World Cup tournament will kick off on the 20th of November. Usually, rats are associated with garbage and disease, but these rats are not the typical rodents. They are being trained in Tanzania for search and rescue operations. These are a breed called the African giant pouch rat, which is naturally a very curious creature. It can weigh up to around 1,500 grams and are known to have longer lifespans than other rats. Lead researcher at the Belgium-based non-profit company Apopo, Donna Keen, says this species can live up to 10 years. This means that even after the 9 months of training, the rat will still have a long working career ahead. The size and agility of rats make them invaluable for search and rescue efforts.
So this is where the idea for the rats came in, because the rats are just as trainable as dogs. They've got a great sense of smell, and their small size and natural agility should hopefully make them really good in this scenario, where they could squeeze in small spaces and get closer to any victims.
The rescue rats began training in August last year at the Apopo's Training and Research Center. The rodents are fitted with tiny backpacks that enable real-time wireless audio-visual communication. When they find a potential victim, they pull a small handle hanging around their neck to let the rescue handlers know. The rats were trained to locate humans in mock disaster zones, such as aftermath of earthquakes. Apopo has already trained rats to detect landmines and sniff out tuberculosis.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
So much joy can be found in a bottle of luxury perfume, but parting with hundreds of dollars for such scents, I can take the shine off that experience. Now in Syria, a perfumer is helping people smell expensive without digging too deep into their pockets. One whiff of a fragrance is all a Syrian perfumer needs to recreate the scents of luxury brands for a fraction of a cost. That's very welcome in a country ravaged by years of foreign-backed militancy. Dozens of customers flock daily to his tiny store nestled in the historic bazaar of Damascus. They flash photos on their phones of high-end perfumes they want to replicate. He says all he has is his nose.
Here lies the secret of the profession and the brain power. I started training my nose to smell perfumes since I was 15 years old. I do not own high-end equipment. All I have is my nose, my brain power and expertise. That's all.
In the war-torn country, many people struggle to afford life's bare necessities, let alone perfume. With the local currency losing much of its value, Syrian employees reportedly make roughly $25 a month, on average a quarter of the price of a bottle of imported perfume. This perfumer sells his fragrances for about $6, drawing in a flow of clients from all walks of life.
Some people believe the internet will soon make paper books a thing of the past. In Iraq, book lovers are fighting back. They have launched a book festival offering thousands of free books to encourage the Arab nation to read more. The festival is called Iraq Reads. It's attracted big crowds. Iraqis stood shoulder to shoulder behind long tables covered in books and flipped through hundreds of titles to find the one catching their interest. Some others gather on next to the stands to read under a tree, chat about their newest books, or listen to extracts of literature read aloud through a loudspeaker. One of the organizers says they aim to revive the culture of reading books, reading paper books.
It's a crisis all over the world, not only in Iraq. There is a crisis in terms of reading paper books. One of the goals for our festival is to revive the reading of paper books so that the electronic book does not become an alternative of the paper book.
As part of the festival, 70,000 books have been distributed for free across the country so far. The books covering a wide range of topics were donated by partner libraries. The festival is held in 7 provinces in the Arab country. You have probably seen penny farthings in old books and cartoons, the antique bicycle with one very large and one small wheel. Now, this peculiar bike actually brings fans together in Prague each year to show off their skills. The cyclists were all dressed in historical costumes as they rode in formation at Letno Park in Prague. The traditional one-mile race competition was also held to see who could go the fastest while keeping their balance. The riders, mostly elderly men, said they came there for just the fun of it. Penny farthings were invented around 1870 and were popular until models with two evenly sized wheels and chains were developed. Most bicycles today are based on this design. Egypt is marking 100 years since the discovery of a tomb of Tutankhamun, a pharaoh who ruled more than 1,300 years B.C.
I was fascinated with the story myself, and every morning in which I was here to pick up our inspector when I was working on a dig in the Valley of the Kings, I would wander around the house trying to imagine what it was like if I had been here in 1922 and could have been a part of that. And now here we are, now that it's restored. I do hope that this will turn into a center of cultural interest for anyone and everyone who wants to visit Egypt and wants to hear more of the story about Howard Carter and the king.
In 1922, British Egyptologist Howard Carter and his team discovered Tutankhamun's nearly intact tomb. That was the start of what became a 10-year project to excavate and conserve more than 5,000 unique artifacts. Tutankhamun's reign lasted barely 9 years in the vast span of ancient Egyptian history. Although his successors tried to erase the king's record from history, the valuable discovery of his tomb has immortalized the boy king.
China is taking the final step in the construction of its Tiangong space station, the second permanently inhabited station in low Earth orbit after NASA's International Space Station. The second and last lab component of the station was launched on Monday. The uncrewed module is called Mengtian, which means dreaming of the heavens. The rocket carrying it blasted off from China's Space Launch Center on the coast of the southern island province of Hainan. The 23-ton Mengtian is an advanced lab and does not have space for sleeping and sanitation. Instead, it has more space to carry payloads for scientific studies. Fan Ping is the chief designer of the project. She says this is a special step towards space research.
I think the Mengtian lab module is quite special, as it is for experiment only, which can be seen as a dedicated studio. There are 13 scientific experiment racks in the module and 37 exposed loading stations outside the module, enabling astronauts to do more extravehicular loading experiments in the future.
The Mengtian module is the last building block of the T-shaped Tiangong station. It has to fly 400 kilometers to join the two-module combination already dispatched into space. Together, the three modules will construct the station, which is designed for a lifespan of at least 10 years.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrowshahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries, ulama and scholars all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about one of the greatest philosophers and jurists of the 13th century Hijra, maybe the most outstanding philosopher and Muslim philosopher of the 13th and Hakim of the 13th century Hijra, Mullah Hadi Sabzawari, the author of Manzuma. We'll talk more about this outstanding magnum opus of Mullah Hadi Sabzawari. Before anything, let's be more a little bit concerned with the early life of Mullah Hadi Sabzawari. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Hakim Sabzawari or Mullah Hadi Sabzawari is born in 1212 according to lunar calendar. For our listeners to get to know about his time, I mean the birth time according to Gregorian calendar, he is born in 1797, almost at the end of 8th century. He is born to a religious family. Actually, his father was a merchant, but he was well known of doing good charity and good things upon the poor people. He was born in Sabzawar, a northeastern city in Iran.
Yes.
He benefited from the great ulama of his time. When Mullah Hadi Sabzawari was 8 years old, he joined the scholarly life, or better to say, he initiated his scholarly life, learned Adabiyat Arab, and when he was 10 years old, with his father, moved to Mashhad and benefited from the seminary school of Mashhad, next to Imam Rida alayhi salam. He two times intended to go to Mecca. On one of his trips, he lost his wife in Kerman. Actually, he was forced to stay in Kerman on his way back to Mashhad because of the insecurity of the ways after the demise of Fath Ali Shah Qajar. So because of his stay in Kerman, in that stay, he lost his wife and stayed in the seminary school of Ma'sumiyyah in Kerman. He didn't expose his personality that he is Mullah Hadi, who has produced these poetry regarding the falsafa and mantiq philosophy and logic that later on we will discuss about it. And there's a very nice memory regarding his stay over there that if we get time, we can talk about that memory.
That's all right. Mainly, Mullah Hadi Sabzawari is known as the reviver of Islamic hikmah, especially, we can say, with the manner and with the research style of
Mullah Sadra. He's the reviver of Sadra philosophy and hikmah. Let's talk a little bit about his research methodology and his main interest.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Mullah Hadi Sabzawari rahmatullah alayhi, as you mentioned, did not establish his own school of thought in philosophy, but he continued the manner and method of Mullah Sadra rahmatullah alayhi as the head of Hikmatul Muta'aliyah.
Yes.
And we should know before his book, Manzumeh, that is a poetry book regarding falsafa and hikmat, the school of thought of Mullah Sadra could not be understood by many people easily. Oh. And people could not get, you know, connected to this school of thought.
Yes.
Not that easy. So, Marhum Mullah Hadi Sabzawari decided to write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that book was composing poems.
Yes.
Regarding philosophy. And he named this one as Manzume, that in English we may say galaxy.
Yes.
And
of course, Manzume, if coming from Nazm, means poet too, or poetic, because we have Nazm and Nasr. Yeah. Nasr is prose and Nazm is poem, okay?
Yeah.
So Manzume also means poetic collections too, but Manzume has another meaning too. It means galaxy, or for example...
Even in Arabic, because galaxy is full of, you know, order.
Yes.
And that's why in Arabic they call it galaxy. Manzume,
yes.
Standing for galaxy also, because every part of galaxy you may find inside it order in very detailed type.
You mean Mullah Hadi selected poetic style of writing in order to make the concepts posed by Mullah Sadra easier to understand, isn't
yes.
it?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
And make it, you know, maybe somehow
tangible
and to make people feel this mm-hmm. concept.
Okay.
Of course, this book is not that easy.
That's easy to understand.
Because
yes.
poem has its, you know, needs its necessities yes. to be understood. Yes. So his son, Mullah Muhammad Sabzawari, wrote an explanation and, you know, exegesis on this book, Manzume.
Yes.
So because poetry has its style and need, you know, its mind to be understood by people, so Mullah Hadi Rahmatullah Alayhi decided to write an explanation on this book,
yes.
on his own book, and named this as Sharh Manzume.
Yes.
And this one is not in poetry style,
mm-hmm.
but it has the poems inside it,
mm-hmm.
and the explanation comes afterwards. And many other books are also written to explain this
yes.
book,
yes.
Sharh Manzume.
Okay.
One of them is written by his son, Mullah Muhammad.
Yes.
And also, Marhum Mullah Muhammad Kazim Khurasani, Akhund
yes.
Khurasani,
yes.
Rahmatullah Alayhi, has wrote a book explaining the Sharh Manzume, and also Sayyid Abul Hassan Rafi Ghazvini,
yes.
And also Imam Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayhi. All these scholars have written some books explaining Sharh Manzume, Mullah Hadi Sabzawari.
And it was the we can say the point of focus for so many scholars in the coming generation after Mullah Hadi Sabzawari. Explain a little bit for us, Sheikh Mahtavi, about the book Manzume of Mullah Hadi Sabzawari.
Okay, regarding the book, we have to say the common format or the common version of the book that right now we have available in our hands is printed in five volumes. The first volume has been dedicated to the mantiq or logic, and the next four volumes he is talking about the philosophy,
mm-hmm.
the way that Mullah Sadra is presenting philosophy,
okay.
as my brother mentioned, because also in another session we talked about this, that we have two common approach in philosophy. One is the Mashai approach, which belongs to Ibn Sina,
yes.
and another is Ishraqi approach, which belongs to Sheikh
Sohrawardi.
Yes. So Mullah Sadra, or if we want to get to more details regarding to these two approaches in philosophy, we have to say Ibn Sina's approach upon the philosophy could be presented as a kind of very logical approach employing reasoning and intellect. But when it comes to Sohrawardi's approach upon the philosophy, you will have the way he is applying intuition, shahud, mukashafa,
yes,
and mystical approach. It's kind of mystical approach upon the philosophy. But what Mullah Sadra did, I mean, the great achievement of Mullah Sadra in his Hikmat-e Muta'aliyah is to merge between these two approaches and present a new style for philosophy, specifically Islamic philosophy.
Yes.
So as my brother mentioned, Sharh Manzumeh Mulla Hadi is a kind of simplifying what Mulla Sadra has said.
Yes.
So for those who want to start Al-Asfar, the Mulla Sadra, yes, they have to get some classes in Sharh Manzumeh as a preliminary step,
yes,
to get prepared.
Okay.
So as my brother mentioned, before this Sharh Manzumeh, it was really, really difficult and complicated for the students to get to know what Mullah Sadra has said in his Al-Asfar. But the achievement of Mullah Hadi in his book is really acknowledged in a sense that he has simplified everything which Mullah Sadra has talked about. In the whole book, we have seven maqasid, al-maqasid al-sab'a.
Yes.
In starting from the Umur al-Amma, which is talking about the logical issues,
mm-hmm,
in mantiq. And then it gets into the Jawahir wa A'rad. For sure, we have a technical,
yes,
usages,
sir,
for all of these maqasid, because it's a kind of technical term.
Yes, yes.
By the way, for those who are interested, they may look it up in, mm-hmm, the available website. And I've heard that some of the Sharh Manzumeh has been translated in a group.
Yes.
Of the philosopher, Iranian philosophers, among which we had Sayyid Hussein Nasr and Mehdi Muhaqqiq.
Yes.
And the first volume had been printed in New York.
Yes.
So I think they will have a good access to English version for those who are interested in, yes, this achievement of, okay, Mullah Hadi Sabzawari.
That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Mulla Hadi Sabzawari was a teacher of akhlaq too, isn't it? I mean, his akhlaqi part is usually neglected, and his, I mean, hikmah and philosophical scholarly life is usually highlighted.
Yes, because, you know, he was from a wealthy family.
Mm-hmm.
His father had properties, lands, and in the city of Sabzawar, and they were wealthy. And after the demise of his father, all this property came to Mullah Hadi Sabzawari, rahmatullah alayhi. But beside all these properties that was under his control and was for him, he had a really humble life, so that his breakfast always was just tea and some bread, and his lunch was some yogurt with some bread again. So even when he was in Kerman, coming back from his trip to Hajj, because his wife got sick in that city, so he had to stay there for almost 3-4 years. And during his stay over there, he didn't inform people that he was a scholar. And he decided to serve the students in the Islamic seminary in Kerman, that the name of the seminary was Ma'sumiyye Seminary. And he was washing the washrooms and, you know, serving the Tolab and the students of that seminary for 3 years anonymously.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, because one of the students asked him a question regarding some, you know, hard stuff, and Mullah Hadi, rahmatullah alayhi, explained the answer in details to him. And that student went to his teacher and gave the answer to his teacher, and the teacher told him that this answer is not yours. Please tell me from where have you brought this answer to me. And at this moment, they understood that Mullah Hadi Sabzawari is a scholar, but we should know that afterwards, he left that city without any delay, because he didn't want people to, you know, admire him and to gather around him. Even when the king of Iran visited him, because the king was going to Mashhad and Sabzawar was on his way. Nasir al-Din Shah, the king, went to visit Mullah Hadi Sabzawari, because everyone went to visit the king, but Mullah Hadi did not move from his house. So the king said, okay, because he is a knowledgeable man, let us go and visit him. Mm-hmm. And when they met, the king told him that, I want to give you a gift. Ask me whatever you want. And Mullah Hadi said that, I'm a needless man in this world, so I have no request from you.
Yes.
And the king then said, okay, I will give you an exemption from your taxes. And it shows the precise look that Mullah Hadi had on his life. He said that, okay, if you give me this discount, then your agents will take this taxes from different people.
That's right.
Because they want to compensate. So again, I do not want to have this. And he refused every request from mm-hmm. the king. So okay. It shows that he even did not pay attention to the king of Iran at that time.
Yes.
That was the first man in power.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziyanian, Sheikh Mahdavi. But all in all, Mullah Hadi Sabzawari is also welcomed very much by the letterist, I mean the men of literature, all across, we can say, the Persian lands. For example, Allama Iqbal Lahuri has wrote explanations on his poetry. And it is really difficult, at the same time, very much shocking, that how a philosopher can, we can say, convey his messages, and very complicated messages, in the poetic forms. And this is, I think, the capacity of the Persian, at the same time, Arabic language, that can have in themselves philosophical concepts. Mullah Muhammad Kazem Ibn Akhund, one of the students of Mullah Hadi Sabzawari, has said a poem about his date of death in Persian language. Tarikh vafatash arbejui guyam ke namord zende tar shud, ke namord zende tar shud, in abjad letters becomes 1289, which is the exact date of the death and demise of Mullah Hadi Sabzawari. At the age of 77, he passed away, and now his burial place is in the city of Sabzawar. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyania and Sheikh Mahdavi, for a nice explanation regarding the life of Mullah Hadi Sabzawari and his manzume, and also his Sharh Manzume, one of the most outstanding, or it's better to say the best and the most prominent philosopher, Muslim philosopher of the 13th century Hijra. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. To another episode introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي.
What non-Muslims say about Ali, the first successor of Prophet Muhammad. Robert Duray Osborne, 1835 to 1889, Major of the Bengal Staff Corps, says the following about Imam Ali in his book Islam Under the Arabs, page 120. With him perished the truest hearted and best Muslim of whom Muhammadan history had preserved the remembrance.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam.
So, dear friends, we are talking about the beautiful persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this persona which has been able to transcend both time, place, and era, and this persona, of course, who was sourced and connected to the Almighty Allah as he was the first divinely appointed Imam. And, of course, this persona which was the manifestation and the embodiment of the true teachings of the pure Muhammadan Islam, the teachings of the Quran, and the teachings of the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Now, one of the things that we see in the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this idea of living a simple lifestyle. Now, this is something in today's day and age which is rarely seen. Most of the people are so engulfed in consumerism and materialism, and they have become this integral part of this machinery of capitalism and this incessant and continuous idea of buying as much as we can, and in many cases, I mean, not even living within our means. A lot of people have to take out credit, and that credit incurs an interest upon it, and then you become debt slaves. Now, what's interesting is all of this kind of, all of these problems, such as debt slavery, or this incessant addiction to be continuously buying, or to become a cog in this wicked machinery of capitalism, all of these are sourced in what? They are sourced in this idea that we do not want to live a simple lifestyle. We want to live as luxurious as possible, because as they say in the capitalistic, materialistic-driven societies, you only have one life to live, so live to the fullest. Whereas in the Islamic model and in the Islamic teachings, the worldly life is just a means. And the worldly life is not the only life. The actual life and the real life, as the Holy Quran tells us, is the hereafter. It is the akhirah. It is the time after we die where eternity begins but never ends. And precisely we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, during his own life, lived an incredibly simple lifestyle. Now, you might say, well, Imam Ali lived a simple lifestyle when he wasn't the caliph. But of course, when he gained power and position and a potentiality of gaining wealth, then he must have changed. Rather, we see that when Imam Ali alayhi salam became the caliph of the Muslims, it is the opposite. His simple lifestyle became much more severe, to the point where he told one of his companions that you cannot do what I am doing because it is so difficult to live that severity of a simple lifestyle that Imam Ali alayhi salam was living, eating an incredibly dry bread made of barley. So some of us might think, well, what does that mean? Well, not only was it dry, if it's dry, it's very hard to chew. And two, barley bread is not as sweet naturally as white bread, for example, or wheat bread is. Barley bread is a little bit bitter, it's a little bit sour. And so this is the lifestyle that Imam Ali alayhi salam lived. Now, this doesn't mean that we stop eating our regular food or we stop, you know, wearing clothes that are appropriate for our position and our status. Of course, within a average and mediocre means, you know. But it does mean that we need to think twice about what is extravagant in our life, what is a luxury in our life, and what is a need in our life. And we must make sure not to confuse a need with a luxury and a luxury with a need, and we really need to reflect and think about how we can live a simple lifestyle. And if we follow this very relatively simple prescription of the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which is to lead and live a simple, humble, yet satisfied and contented life, I can guarantee you that we will be able to solve many, many of the problems that come about because of a materialistic, capitalistic, and consumeristic-driven society which many of us are faced with in the present day.
A beautiful, profound, thought-provoking lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك شارعا وعلى القاصدين
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear, and the doors of approval are kept open. For them, whoso submits his supplication to Thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto Thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of Thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from Thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for Thy help, procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with Thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for Thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from Thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by Thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
Why should we be proud? You will notice human nature is to worship heroes. Hero worship is common. People go to watch movies because they love to watch heroes. Comic book shops sell all those fantasy stories because we love to worship heroes. Hero worship is a natural phenomenon. But all of that is fantasy. It's not real. Such people don't exist. Superman doesn't exist. Spider-Man doesn't exist. They don't exist. And even if you're talking about great kings that came, they were false in many ways in their character. They were not good role models. But Imam Ali alayhi wasalam, the one who dislodges such personalities, yet he was so humble. So humble, so down to earth that you and I need to follow. I give you a simple example. One example you find is, many a times you and I notice when we give charity, We give charity with strings attached. And when we give it, we make people feel bad. You know, when you do Allah's work, it's very hard to go to people and say, give a few dollars for Allah's work. They feel they're doing a big thing for Allah. And in their minds, Surah Yasin mentions that, I'll talk about it some other time. In their minds they're saying, why does God want me to contribute when He's so rich He can contribute Himself? Look at this notion. So we have strings attached. When we give charity and we make people feel bad.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at